This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 6th of May, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, we go to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where Bahraini citizens accuse the royal family of war crimes. In Syria, thousands of people continue their push for democratic rights, and in protests across the country are met with live ammunition and tear gas. And, as gloomy unemployment figures are released in the US, we explore an alternative to paid employment, the time bank, where people trade time instead of money. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The fallout from Osama bin Laden's death continues in Pakistan today. Anti-U.S. protests happened in three cities. The Taliban has issued threats against government officials. In addition to NATO forces in Afghanistan and NATO supply lines in Pakistan, and there are early reports of a bomb blast at a club in Karachi. Rose Kitabchi reads for FSRN's Gabe Matthews, who reports from Pakistan.
The Taliban has traditionally launched attacks against targets on Fridays, especially during Friday prayers. Because of the threat, almost all international non-governmental organizations and multinational companies in Pakistan have closed their offices and advised staff to avoid public places. 24-year-old Rabia Shafi works in a U.S.-based NGO focused on flood relief.
Obviously, every time I feel that now there will be some suicide bomber, it will come, and now there will be a blast, and every time I'm just thinking about it.
In other news, a U.S. drone strike has killed 12 people in North Waziristan. It's the first reported drone strike since the operation to kill Osama bin Laden. Several news agencies quote Pakistani intelligence officials as saying those killed were suspected militants. But a source on the ground in the region tells FSRN that most of the dead are civilians. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan, Rose Kitabchi, FSRN.
Nearly 2 months after a devastating earthquake and tsunami leveled parts of Japan, Prime Minister Naoto Kan addressed the nation last night in a rare live TV speech. He made the first ever direct request that a nuclear plant be shut down. Not the crippled plant in Fukushima, but at Hamaoka, 124 miles west of Tokyo. This plant has recently become a special target for Japan's anti-nuclear campaigners. FSRN's Claudia Cragg has more.
PM Kan gave an impromptu TV address to the nation, asking the Chubu Power Company to shut down Hamaoka's two active reactors as soon as possible. Ever since the March 11 earthquake, activists in Japan have staged widespread protests about the lack of full disclosure about plants with a history of earthquake-related problems. Hamaoka is sited directly on top of a major earthquake fault, and despite the loss it will cause to the nation's, and particularly the capital's, power supply, PM Kan said the plant must close for 2 years while a higher seawall is built to guard against tsunami. It's expected that the Hamaoka plant operators will comply. Claudia Cragg, FSRN.
Hundreds of people are marching to the Mexican capital today in the lead up to national demonstrations against drug war violence planned for this weekend. FSRN's Shannon Young has more.
Activists set out on a march from Cuernavaca Wednesday to call for justice for the nearly 40,000 people murdered in Mexico's militarized drug war. Many in the march have lost family members in the violence, including poet Javier Cecilia, who has become the movement's figurehead. Cecilia penned an open letter to the government and organized crime in April and has tapped into widespread frustration over Mexico's pervasive levels of impunity. The emerging social movement is calling for a change in the 4.5-year-old drug war strategy that is increasingly claiming the lives of civilians. The peace march from Cuernavaca is due to reach the central plaza of Mexico City on Sunday. Solidarity demonstrations will take place in more than 30 cities across Mexico this weekend. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Vermont's legislature has passed a health care reform bill designed to provide high-quality, universal insurance coverage for all residents. The insurance would control costs by paying health care providers for good outcomes rather than for the number of procedures they perform. Governor Pete Shumlin is expected to sign the bill with great fanfare next week. FSRN's Carl Ettmeyer is in the Capitol.
For Vermonters, the Federal Affordable Care Act did not go far enough. Governor Shumlin campaigned last fall on a promise to set up a single-payer health care system in the state with coverage for all residents, regardless of where or whether they are employed. The bill, which gained final passage Thursday afternoon, creates a system called Green Mountain Care, which does not quite get the state to a single-payer system, but it does start a process that could produce single-payer coverage in the coming years. Private insurance plans will continue to be available, but Mark Larson, chair of the House Health Care Committee, wonders who will sign up for them.
People may want to go out and purchase supplemental insurance beyond that, but I think people will be very pleased with the services that would be covered by Green Mountain Care.
Much remains to be worked out, including how it will be paid for. A 5-person board will be appointed later this year to start that work. Carl Ettinger, FSRN, Montpelier.
Attorney General Eric Holder has annulled a decision by a federal immigration court asking it to reconsider the case of a binational gay couple facing deportation. Paul Dorman and his unnamed partner are in a New Jersey civil union. An immigration court ruled that because of the Defense of Marriage Act, the men could not be considered married and were consequently not eligible for immigration protections. But Holder's decision, made public yesterday, said he wanted the judges to consider other factors in the case not directly related to DOMA. Earlier this year, the Justice Department announced it would cease to defend DOMA in court, calling it unconstitutional. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood, in San Francisco. Today at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, lawyers representing 5 Bahrainis presented a case against the Bahraini royal family and members of the regime, accusing them of war crimes. The lawyers presented evidence taken from events in Bahrain since the recent unrest started in mid-February. Yasser al-Sayeg is one of the plaintiffs, and 15 years ago he himself was a victim of torture under Bahrain's regime. He joins us now from The Hague. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Hello.
Now, your lawyers presented your case today before an ICC prosecutor. How did it go?
Yes, the lawyer have presented the case to the ICC prosecutor. Evidence based on what actually happened in Bahrain on 15th of February and onward. And the evidence was showing the clear violation of a human right. So the case was accepted, and we have been given the number 117/11.
So you say clear violations of human rights. What exactly are the charges?
The charges, according to our defense team, is a genocide and what happened on Pearl Square on 17 and onwards. Class as violation and genocide, a crime against a humanitarian.
Now, you yourself were a victim of torture under Bahrain's regime, but I understand your case isn't actually part of this testimony. You've been living in exile in the UK for the last 15 years. Can you just tell us about how you came to be detained by the authorities in Bahrain?
Yes, I was detained for 8 months. I went and undergone tremendous torture, including beating, lack of sleep, and was physical and psychological torture, mental torture, denying all the basic rights, no access to lawyer, no access to family member, as my family are actually, my wife, she's British, and my son was living in the UK, so I had no access to them whatsoever to have. And obviously the torture and the beating, we were like standing up all night and never sleep. Then they start threatening us with smoke, with a cigarette. So whenever we talk, they will burn us with the cigarette. They also threatened us to use a drill and all of that. Just because we were, because of this tiny, small article on the newspaper was found in my desk.
You have family and friends back in Bahrain. Are you able to communicate with them, and what's the latest you've heard from them?
I'm really fearing that someone will attack my family, and they might be arrested, they might be insulted, that might be, you know, they might attack them at any time.
Can I just ask you, what was the most important thing in making you decide to bring your case to the International Criminal Court?
Is the people, the number of people who have been killed in period of time as less than 1 month, the type of the torture the people have get, the people who have been arrested, girls, 19 years old, school girls, they attack school girls, they attack children, they attack families, they have raided houses in midnight, attacking people with tanks, with Apache air helicopter for innocent people. And the world have witnessed what happened in the Pale Square, where the people were sleeping, and what we have seen, the army came and attacked the people in there, and they have actually destroyed the place. They use a huge and massive force against innocent people. People of Bahrain, they were raising the flowers and they were marching peacefully. Slogan, their slogan was peace, peace, peace. The only things they were slogan, and they are really, really is upsetting for us to see this kind of aggressive regime being the world being quiet about.
So what's the next step in your case at the International Criminal Court?
We are pursuing this case, and we have called upon the ICC to take action as soon as possible. The ICC should send an investigation team or investigation commission to Bahrain to investigate our claim and investigate the matter, in the hope that the torture and the killing be stopped as soon as possible.
Yasser Al-Sayegh, one of the plaintiffs in this war crimes case against Bahrain's royal family from The Hague, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much indeed for you and for your listener. Bye-bye now.
In Syria, thousands of people in dozens of cities demonstrated across the country, and security forces responded with cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Many city central squares were blocked off, but following Friday prayers, residents formed spontaneous rallies in outlying streets and neighborhoods. More than a dozen were killed. In this footage uploaded to YouTube, many hundreds of people rally in a square today, said to be in the town of Jassem, south of Deraa. Deraa is the city that's been under siege by the military for the last 11 days. Some members of the Red Cross were able to finally enter Deraa, and video footage purportedly of the city shows buildings riddled with bullet holes, walls painted with X's, and smashed and burned out vehicles. Human rights activist Wissam Tarif reports there is still an army presence in Deraa, despite an announcement by the army that they would leave. He told The Guardian that following the government's bloody crackdown, protesters have changed tactics, including in Midan, a historic quarter of Damascus.
Today, Midan protest is bigger than it was in the last 2 weeks. It left from Al-Hassan Mosque, and people from other areas around Al-Midan, as we're speaking, I'm receiving feedback that are trying to join them in Midan. So, of course, people are aware that at this stage of the regime brutality, the regime oppression, they have to act themselves, neighborhood by neighborhood, and I think that's what we're seeing now in inside Damascus and Midan area.
Tarif's human rights group, INSAN, says more than 600 people have been killed and about 2,800 detained since the unrest began. Journalists are among those being arrested. Al Jazeera says the Syrian authorities have now admitted to holding their reporter, Dorothy Parvaz, who has been missing since last Friday. Meanwhile, in Yemen today, there were massive rallies in the capital Sana'a and the second largest city, Taiz. Demonstrators are renewing their calls for President Ali Abdullah Saleh to step down. Crowd sizes were difficult to confirm, but ranged from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands. Part of the protests included releasing thousands of balloons with the words "Leave Ali" marked on them. In Sana'a, a simultaneous rally of thousands of pro-government supporters also took place. Since the protests began in late January, more than 100 have been killed. Thailand's Prime Minister announced today that he's formally requested that Parliament be dissolved. If approved by the King, this would lead the way to general elections this summer. Elections were a key demand of red shirt protesters, many of them supporters of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who was ousted in a military coup 5 years ago. Prime Minister Abhisit Vejjajiva promised elections last November, following protests earlier that year, that left dozens dead and hundreds injured. A year after the violence, no one has been charged with any crimes, and human rights observers say the government, military and protest leaders share responsibility for the bloodshed and crackdown. Ron Corbin reports.
Thailand, heading towards general elections, remains divided over the 2010 anti-government protests in Bangkok. It was the worst political violence in two decades and 90 people were killed. In a report released this week, Human Rights Watch criticizes the government for failing to hold anyone responsible for the deaths and injuries both by security forces shooting protesters and by armed militants firing on soldiers. Human Rights Watch's Asia Director Brad Adams says the Thai government should do more to investigate the deaths and bloodshed.
The government may say that they're going to investigate individual cases, and we'll come to whether they've done a good job of that, but well, they should. But there's a major policy issue here. The government cannot simply say that in the heat of attempts to clear demonstrators from the streets of Bangkok, some soldiers may have exceeded their orders. The government provided these orders. And the army put these snipers in place, and people died. And that will need to be addressed.
The protests were led by the United Democratic Front for Democracy Against Dictatorship, or UDD, better known as Red Shirts. These are supporters of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, ousted in a coup in 2006. In April, when the military moved to clear the streets, they came under fire by armed militants. At least five soldiers, including the operational commander, died, along with 20 protesters. Hundreds, both civilians and military, were injured. The final crackdown came on May 19. A Human Rights Watch report, based on dozens of interviews, documents deadly attacks by armed forces on protesters and abuses by armed elements known as the Black Shirts, aligned with the UDD. Tita Tavonset, a UDD leader, says many issues surrounding the crackdown need to be resolved.
1 year has passed since the violent dispersion of the mass demonstration. Rear bullets were used to disperse the masses. Last but not least, sniper posted on high ground, wounded and caused the death of innumerable number of people. This unresolved situation has forced the UDD raid in the land to continue demanding justice. That is long overdue.
The UDD denies they were supported by armed groups. But Adams with Human Rights Watch is skeptical of this claim.
The Red Shirts' rhetoric continues to be that they're a peaceful movement and that they are only victims. They've said, for example, that the Black Shirts either don't exist, didn't exist, or had been planted by the government. In fact, I believe that was said here last week at an FCCT event by Red Shirt leaders. This is essentially propaganda. Red Shirt leaders welcomed Black Shirt leaders publicly as early as January of 2010.
He says a climate of systemic impunity within the Thai military also needs to be addressed.
Impunity has been the foundation for human rights abuses in Thailand for as long as we can remember. Human Rights Watch concludes that there will be no rule of law and there will be no respect for human rights so long as the military remains above the law in Thailand.
On May 19, as hundreds of protesters sheltered in a Buddhist temple complex near the rally site, they came under fire by armed men, killing six people, including two volunteer medics. Pawar Akahadhad, the mother of a 25-year-old volunteer medic, Kamakate, who was fatally shot, hopes for an end to the violence.
แต่สิ่งที่เป็นความจริงก็คือทหารในกองทัพนี้ฆ่าแม้กระทั่งอาสาพยาบาล
But the truth is, the military, the army, in fact, they killed even a nurse, a volunteer nurse. What I want to call for is that the military should I hope that the military would stop killing the people, wouldn't come out to kill the people anymore.
The Thai government has set up investigative panels into the bloodshed, but the process is slow, hampered by a lack of military cooperation. Human Rights Watch also warns of a continuing government crackdown on the media after some Red Shirt community radio stations were closed down. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
A leaked draft of an executive order would require federal contractors to disclose more of their political activities. Watchdog groups are urging President Obama to issue the order in the name of transparency, while critics call it a political power grab. Michael Lawson has more.
The order being crafted in the White House is seen as a response to the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which opened the door to unlimited spending on elections by corporations and labor unions. A draft leaked sometime in April would require contractors submitting bids to disclose political contributions over $5,000 made by the company and its officers in the preceding 2 years. While some disclosure of political donations by federal contractors is already required, this executive order expands that to include donations made to third-party groups. The information would be published in a searchable database on data.gov. Spending by third-party groups who do not have to disclose the names of their donors defined the record-breaking totals spent in the 2010 midterm elections following the Citizens United decision. Mary Boyle of Common Cause says this is about bringing to light information that citizens need to make decisions about democracy.
Well, the Chamber of Commerce spent something like $33 million on election communications in the 2010 midterm elections. Any government contractor who contributed to that pot of money would have had to disclose that.
Common Cause is one of several organizations who joined in submitting a letter to the White House on Wednesday, urging the president to sign off on the executive order. The Center for Competitive Politics sent its own letter on Wednesday detailing its concerns with the language in the executive order. The center says the order would increase the potential for political influence in the bidding process. Jeff Patch is a spokesperson for the organization.
Even progressives should be concerned about what a future Republican president may do with such data. I mean, it would be relatively easy for political appointees at these agencies to make decisions on contracting based on political considerations, whereas right now they don't have that information when they're considering the contracts.
Patch and other critics of the order say the language does not appear to include unions that negotiate with the federal government and receive grants. A 1992 executive order issued originally by President George H.W. Bush required contractors to tell unionized employees that union dues do not have to go to political purposes. According to Patch, that order, repealed by President Clinton, reinstated by President George W. Bush, and repealed by President Obama, shows the politicized nature of campaign finance-related executive orders.
Campaign finance laws should really be left to Congress and the FEC so there can be even-handed regulations of campaign finance that don't single out unions for punishment or conversely single out the business community for targeting for political purposes.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell called the order a rehashing of the Disclose Act, which failed in Congress last year and would have prohibited contractors from making campaign-related expenditures. Boyle says greater disclosure laws through Congress would be ideal, but are not a reality.
Would it be preferable to have some kind of legislation go through the process in the public? Yes, but that's not happening. And we are quickly approaching a presidential election that we expect to basically blow the doors off any kind of spending records that have existed.
At least 25 Republican senators sent a letter opposing the language of the executive order, saying it would have a chilling effect if contractors must be worried about their political views becoming part of their livelihood. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has also spoken out against the order. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney has said the president's goal is, quote, transparency and accountability. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
The Labor Department released new job numbers today, showing a slight increase in the official unemployment rate from 8.8% to 9%. The rate for black workers at 16% is double that of whites, and for teens it's nearly 25%. But the so-called real unemployment is much higher, at 15.9%. This category includes people who are available for full-time work, but who've had to take part-time jobs or who've given up an active job search. The tough economy has been forcing people to find creative ways to make ends meet, and some communities are using alternative economic models to get by. Today we're going to explore one of those alternatives, the time bank. It's a sort of barter system where people trade time instead of money. First created in the 1980s, it's seeing a resurgence in the US. From KMEC Radio in Ukiah, California, Christina Anasted has the story.
At the Ukiah Healthcare Center, a group of seniors gather around banjo player Daniel Fry. For this work, Fry isn't getting paid in cash, nor is he volunteering.
A new form of wealth is the way I would define it.
Fry participates in the Time Bank program, in which he gains an hour of someone else's time for each hour he plays the banjo.
It's really amazing way to meet new people and to do things that get services that I wouldn't normally have. Like I've had a guy chop all my firewood, chainsaw it, chop it, help me on my house.
Here in Mendocino County, 12% of the population is unemployed, so many people are looking for ways to get by without the dollar bill. Julia Freck is a time bank coordinator.
When money is tight, we tend to spend less on certain things like voice lessons or fresh eggs or a massage. And a time bank can fill in those gaps because we can offer that to each other, and our means of exchange is our time and not money. So a time bank facilitates exchanges that wouldn't normally happen because we wouldn't be able to afford them.
There are many ways to use the time bank program. Freck and her partner trade 3 pounds of meat for every hour of service they use. Others offer vegetables, auto repair, and massage therapy. Freck estimates 100 people in Mendocino are participating in the time bank, but says she'd like to see it grow. Residents use an online computer software program to keep track of people's time and services. Again, Freck.
Once your time is logged, it will automatically come from your account into the other person's account, or vice versa. It's like a bank account, where if all of you guys had, your own bank account and you were just trading money in between.
Instead of relying on money, the time bank allows communities to rely on each other, making a town, city, and community more resilient in these tough economic times. The downside, according to Frack, is because the Mendo Time Bank is online, it's more of a challenge for rural residents and low-income people to participate if they don't have internet access. Currently, the Mendo Time Bank doesn't have dentists or doctors participating, but other time banks do, like the one in Portland, Maine. The largest time bank is in the state of Wisconsin, with an estimated 1,500 members. Their membership nearly doubled in 2009 after the economic downturn. There are also time banks in over 13 countries, including Japan, Spain, and Chile. Christina Anasted, FSRN, Ukiah, California.
And that's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.